The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. You may have noticed that one Whole Foods Market store is not like the other. We're proud that each of our stores has its own quirks, a direct connection to the surrounding community, and buys and sells their own products. Whether it's artisanal chocolates exclusive to Bowery, small batch pickles in Chelsea, or a featured craft beer on tap at West 97th, you'll find that each store is a little bit different than the next. With six Manhattan locations, Whole Foods Market offers a taste of every neighborhood. Come see us in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hello and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on our half-hour journey through culinary history. And today, I think I'll start out by giving you a little quiz. We're going to talk about a single subject that has many variations. It's one of the oldest and most essential ingredients in our diet. It comes from both the land and the sea, and yet it's so desired and rare and necessary that it quickly became a commodity in early history, traded as currency, and actually became the product of the earliest tax. At the table, it has designated a person's political and social status and was the impetus behind great artists' creations with precious metals. Have you guessed it yet? Those of you with some knowledge would know, of course, we're talking about salt. And we have with us today Mark Bitterman, a sommelier, a salt expert, one of the leading salt experts, actually, and the author of Salted, a manifesto on the world's most essential mineral, with recipes. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
Mark owns two stores. Are they both called The Meadow?
Yes.
The Meadow, and they're salt stores, one in Portland, Oregon, and the other one here in New York City, the newest one here in New York City. You sell salt and other things as well.
We sell salt, chocolate, flowers, and cocktail bitters here in New York, and wine in Portland, Oregon.
But your main focus is salt. That's been the passion of your life. But writing an entire manifesto, it's actually a lovely book, I must say, and up for a James Beard Award, which is being honored this weekend. So congratulations.
I'm trying not
for
to
that.
Hold my breath, but.
Tell me what spawned your interest in salt, and how did this come about? I mean, to devote not only a book but your career.
Yeah, salt was something that I just noticed early on in my traveling and eating, as sort of a uniquely local and prized ingredient. So I'd be traveling through Europe, for example, and eating something and seeing salt play this amazing role or being treated with an immense amount of respect. And I saw that kind of wherever I went. And over time, I started to realize, well, I see that in certain places. Other places, it becomes this kind of homogenous chemical. What gives with these two? And so I started to collect these regional distinctive salts and pay attention to how they're being used in different cuisines. And I guess it's kind of evolved for me into the crystal, if you will, through which I look at food and culture.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you did write about a very colorful story of eating a steak somewhere in France, and then you were suddenly turned on to this wonderful taste.
I still remember that steak. And one of the things that I didn't mention in the book, but kind of parallel to that, I lived for about 3 years in a chateau in the south of France, and we raised
tough life.
It was miserable. restoring the exterior of the building and doing the inside, and I became kind of part of the family and the people that live there. We grew most of our own food, raised lambs, hunted wild boar and mushrooms and all that stuff. And we would be visited by these literally Michelin star chefs from Paris and the Loire Valley. And they would come and little hampers of champagne and favorite goodies. And I was remarking this, I noticed it at one point that they would come and they would put on the table a little cellar of salt. that they had brought with them.
Their own salt. Yeah.
These are people with unlimited resources, unlimited technical skill, unlimited acumen about food in general. And the very, very select things that they would take with them would include salt, I think almost without exception. Hmm. And I thought that was really noteworthy.
Yeah, you can really tell a salt and food connoisseur when they bring out their own salt cellar, for sure. Well, you do challenge people in your book to try, you know, to be more creative in their salting. And you said that they're to explore the dazzling world of salt beyond the iodized curtain. I love that, that you use that all. Because what did we know back in the 50s other than, you know, Morton's iodized salt, you know, or maybe, you know, a couple others, but that was about it. So what I would like to do is before we get on to all these wonderful new salts, not new, old, but have reemerged, is talk a little bit about the history of salt. And you do mention, you do give some background of salt. I mean, as I mentioned at the top of the show, it's one of the oldest produced elements and flavorings that we have. What do we know about the early production?
Yeah, I mean, it's my book does have a chapter on the history of salt, but it's because I'm not a food historian, I took it more from the perspective of the salt. Mm-hmm. What role did salt find itself playing throughout history? And really, if you think about one of the things that's odd about salt is that it's historically been made most in the areas of the world where there is the least surviving evidence of anything, meaning coastal waters, marshes. These are areas that silt over and change completely in the course of decades or hundreds of years, let alone thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So we know nothing about early salt production almost anywhere in the world. But we know anecdotally that different civilizations needed it, and we find it in certain places inland where we find evidence of salt production. What I kind of like to suggest to people is that round about 10,000, 11,000 years ago, at the end of the last ice age, we emerged from the caves and the savannas and started to grow our own food and raise our own animals.
Right.
The day we did that, we needed to start producing salt as a dietary requirement for ourselves and for our livestock. Mm-hmm. So from that day forward, which means, give or take, there was an economic necessity and nutritional necessity for salt sometime around 10,000 years ago. Archaeological evidence for salt doesn't go back that far, but we do have sites from about 6,000 years ago or so, especially in Northern Europe. And there's actually some anthropologists who postulate that probably, that's very likely that settlement patterns across Europe as humankind migrated east through Asia towards the Americas, that those settlement patterns are actually determined by the availability of salt resources.
So they followed a salt trail. Some people followed the spice trail, others followed the salt trail, right? Go figure. Well, and the thing is that salt, I mean, as I mentioned too, that it was rare or it was sought after because it wasn't an easy thing to trade and carry. I mean, took time to produce out of the sea, naturally. Certainly they could find it, you know, and then find it in mines, rock salt, and harvest that. So talk a little bit about the difference between the rock salt and sea salt, mm-hmm. or rock or salt deposits that become rock.
Yeah. The irony of this whole thing is that for all of human history up until about 150 years ago, salt was it was the most consistently precious commodity on the face of the earth.
Right.
And as you are probably at times in Mali, for example, during the rise of the great Malian Empire around Timbuktu, salt traded pound for pound with gold. It was a very, very precious commodity at all times, largely because it's darn heavy, so it's very hard to transport.
Right.
It's universally desired. And the technologies for producing it have been either underdeveloped or non-existent. So the two major ways to get salt out of the world are by mining it or by evaporating off a salt brine. Mining it, believe it or not, it sounds like it would be a really attractive way to do it, but pre-industrialization, mines were really hard to operate and very, very hard to operate for large scale, large volumes of production. So
takes a little more than just chipping away with a pickaxe.
That's exactly right. You wish you could.
Yeah.
But that did happen. If you look at all the towns across Austria, for example, that have the word H-A-L, that's a Celtic determination of having been a salt mine.
Oh, interesting.
And there are some that are very, very old. But to give you an example of how hard it is, as soon as the technology emerged to make it possible to mine that salt without chipping it out with a pickaxe, they went that direction. So now all the salts that are made out of the same area, they pump a solution into the mine, and then a salt water brine comes out, and they boil that off. So the most common ways to make salt historically have been through solar evaporation mm-hmm. and through evaporation using fire. And so there's an ancient technique called briquetage. It's a French term, and it's been used since for as long as anybody knows, including in the present day areas where salt is now made by solar evaporation. So the technology for solar evaporation, believe it or not, is tougher to manage than boiling it. So you take a salt water brine, you put it into a giant ceramic vessel of some sort, and you light a fire underneath it, and then boil off that water or simmer off that water until you get this giant thick puck of salt at the bottom of it. And then you break that ceramic vessel, and you have this cake of salt, and that's what's used to trade.
Yeah. Oh, you showed a picture in your book of a wonderful little cake of, I don't know how little it was. It was hard to tell. Was it, yeah, like
hockey,
a hockey
big
puck.
Big hockey puck.
Yeah, interesting. And that was the form that it would come in.
And that was the advantage of that was that it could be made rain or shine year round mm-hmm. in any climate in the world. The bad part about it was that it required a forest nearby because you'd be cutting down and burning a lot of trees. Nonetheless, very common for many, many, many centuries. There are actually places, for example, in the south of France, where they have always assumed they were just natural rolling hills and mountains, and they determined later that it's actually solid mountains of briquetage that have formed over hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wow.
Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone who's ever had the opportunity to see salt deposits in the ocean, salt deposits, it's marvelous, and watch them raking up the salt from these pans, the shallow pans.
It's really mesmerizing.
Yeah.
If you talk to a salt maker, even nowadays, I've only actually talked to people nowadays. I didn't talk to anybody 100 years ago, but if I could, I would. But if you talk to people, they actually have this. These are practical farmer type people. They're living from the labor of their hands off the land, but they have this almost spiritual reverence for what they're doing to a person. They all talk about it as this almost alchemic, beautiful process of converting the ocean using their hands and the sun to make salt.
All right. I mean, and of course, in early Roman days, I mean, they didn't really have the salt unless somebody came by with some salt that they got, and salt equaled power. Whoever controlled the salt was the powerful one, right? But they would make liquamen or garum, which, just fermenting the fish from the ocean. Well, so the salt.
Fish guts.
Fish guts, right. In a disgusting skin bag, or bury it. But
if
it
I
was
could
a,
get garum and sell it, I would. I swear to God, it just sounds so weird.
You can make it.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant task, but you can make it.
Sauerkraut's my limit.
Yeah. Well, it's akin to that, right? A stinky project. But it was all that salt from the fish, from the ocean. So, I mean, put two and two together, and think of what else you could do. So, indeed, salt was not only just desired, I mean, it was a necessity. So, everything changed come the mid-19th century. Everything changed. It became not what we know, but a big business.
Yeah. Industrialization brought a lot of things. And industrialization on its own could have certainly and had already begun to, salt in a sense has been industrialized since the dawn of time. The Romans made salt on a vast industrial scale, as did many people have. But with the modern era of mechanization, industrialization took an entirely new twist and became vastly larger scale. What coincided with that ability to produce on a larger scale, which probably might never have made that much economic sense on its own, was the advent of a couple chemical processes that allowed chemists to break apart the sodium and the chloride and make a variety of different chemical products. And believe it or not, it was salt that provided the foundation for the entire modern chemical industry. So over 12,000 products that we use in our daily lives are all made out of salt. Hmm. And until recently, actually, salt was the single largest chemical feedstock for the chemical industry. Petroleum now is the bigger one. Yeah. When that happened, it put this enormous, about 97% of the salt that's produced, depending on how you calculate numbers, goes into chemical processes, goes into non-food applications. And so, I should say, not chemical. And so that 97% of the salt that's produced is not culinary salt. It's big industrial markets that consume it. And that completely obliterated everything. No small artisan producer could compete against a large scale, multi-mile square mile salt farm where bulldozers are harvesting the salt.
Right.
They all vanished.
So the culinary salt was just sort of a small byproduct that they would sell off, and it was the extra salt.
Yeah.
Iodized. And the iodized salt, they added iodine to it.
Yeah. I think it's in the 20s. There was a realization, iodine is a very necessary dietary component or nutrient, and normally we get it from vegetables and we get it from seafood and from milk. We get lots of iodine from those sources. There are certain parts of the world, especially during the ages in America, for example, when we had limited trade with other, say, with ports, and before refrigeration, we didn't have seafood or fresh produce available many places. Those areas would become susceptible to iodine deficiency. Mm. And that gives you a bunch of not very nice things that can happen to you.
Right.
So they experimented with iodization of lots of different things. You know, you can iodize flour, you can iodize, they iodize milk, they iodize lots of different things to see what works. But the thing about salt is every single person in the world eats salt in almost the exact same quantities in every single culture of the world. Mm-hmm. So they found this universally consumed product that they could very inexpensively iodate, to basically iodate the entire planet. And it's done an amazing benefit as a sort of public health strategy for these areas that are suffering from iodine deficiency.
So not a bad thing when we talk about additives to foods. That was a healthy thing. That was a good health benefit.
it was a wonderful thing to do to benefit this, to give public health officials a strategy for iodating a population. Mm. But that said, I would venture to say that very few of us today need iodization from our salt. Mm-hmm. For a whole variety of reasons. For one, you get a tremendous benefit from just eating a little bit of fresh vegetables from most places where it's grown. Likewise with milk, two portions of seafood a week give you all the iodine you need. And most multivitamins carry a daily supply of iodine. So you're getting it, plus you're getting it in an ambient way from all the other processed foods where they use iodized salt.
Right.
It's like, don't go to iodized salt as your source for iodine.
Right, and yet it was what we knew during that time. And we're going to talk more about the artisanal salts, but so the majority of the salt that was sold, let's say in the U.S., was all rock salt, mined salt?
Most of the, first off, in terms of the salt that's used, the biggest market in the U.S., there are two major markets that are not culinary. One is road salt. Mm. And there are big mines up in Canada that are pushing 11 million tons of salt a year.
Wow.
From a single mine. It's completely staggering. But that's almost exclusively rock salt for roads and things like
but
that.
But the culinary salt that we shake on our foods before we get to the artisanal.
Most of the salt that we get for food is made by a process called vacuum evaporation. They take basically set up a factory on top of a salt deposit, pump water into the deposit, pump that salty brine out of it, and then put it into a series of boilers that boiled off to concentrate the brine down and crystallize salt.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about taste, the important part of salt. So stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
We are back talking with Mark Bitterman, the author of Salted and a sommelier, a salt expert, and owner of two salt stores. Now, Mark, your stores are the only, that you know of, the only actual salt stores devoted to salt in the U.S. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, actually. I think that's very nice. Let's talk about this reemergence of artisanal salts. I mean, I'm sure that anyone who's, if you haven't been living under a rock, and definitely not a salt rock.
Salt rock.
Right. You've heard of fleur de sel and varieties of salt, Malden salts and the flake salts and the crystal salts. And first of all, tell me a little bit about the difference between flaked salts and crystals.
Yeah, one of the things that was really exciting to do in the book that was sort of a response to a sense of frustration that we just kind of felt was out there in the world is sort of creating a taxonomy, if you will, of salt, breaking down the basic types of salt from a culinary perspective so that you can understand what to expect from a salt and then how to use it. So we came up with, we formalized a basic architecture for it. And what you have are the most popular types, like you mentioned, is fleur de sel, which is a very granular salt with very delicate crystals and a lot of moisture and minerals. And then a flaky salt, for example, like Malden that you mentioned, which are parchment fine crystals with a very kind of more pungent flavor. Mm. And then coarser salts that maybe are chunky and awkward, and then of course rock salts like we talked about that are just a solid crystal lattice where you have to bite through it just like a rock.
Wow.
Not as ideal, or grind it up really, really fine. And so we came up with about seven different categories of salt, about four of which are very common and very popular. So the fleur de sel that we talked about, sel gris, mm-hmm. which many people also know is a coarser silvery gray salt oftentimes. Great for your hearty foods, and then a flaky salt, and then, of course, traditional salt, which is what most natural sea salts are. That's where you, if you ever see like a red Hawaiian salt or a black lava salt or all these esoteric funky
looking salts. Yeah, I was going to talk about colors, too. Yeah, great colors in salts, right? And these are basically from some of the minerals that the trace minerals that are still there in the salt before they're cleaned out?
The colors in most salts, salt naturally will range from brilliant, brilliant white to silver gray to pinkish. And those are kind of the ranges that you'll find it in most often, excepting rock salts. Rock salts can have a ton of mineral inclusions that make them rather wild colors. Himalayan pink salt can be quite like meat red. Or very pale pink, or even yellow. We have some beautiful new yellow salts from Pakistan that are look like saffron. Or even strangest of all would be, say, a blue salt that we have from Germany, which is this. It literally looks like little bits of broken up sapphire inside the salt crystal.
Huh.
So crazy colors that way. Most salts that we see in sort of like a gourmet salt you might see at a store, those brighter colors like the red. Or bolder colors like the red or black, those come from additions after they're produced. So the red clay, for example, that you find in Hawaii on the islands, this very iron-rich red clay, has historically been slightly mixed up in trace amounts in the salt. And to make a more gourmet salt, it's actually just more intentionally added. So you get this gorgeous, lustrous, brick red color.
Well, Harold McGee just wrote an article last week in the New York Times on salt and did mention you and credited you in your book. And suggests that these trace minerals can either suppress or accentuate the saltiness of salt, which, I mean, so it's one way or the other. And how saltiness. One would think that salt is salty, right? But it's not true. It's all a matter of degree in tasting it. You give a very and I want you to talk to that after I describe that you said tasting salt, that you gave almost like how to taste salt, just like one would say how to taste wine or chocolate. Mm-hmm. And like diamonds, it's all about the crystal or the color and the body and the taste. Now, you talk a lot about something, but you didn't mention this as a criteria for tasting, and to me it's essential, and that is the crunch.
Oh, yeah.
The crunch of salt.
To me, and this is an interesting point that, for example, the article in the New York Times didn't touch on, is that to me, salt is it's a whole thing. It's not sodium chloride. If you look at the 100 and so plus salts we have in the store, each one looks completely different than the next. They all have different colors, different sizes, different shapes.
And how many salts do you have in your store?
About 120.
Wow.
And so. It's indispensable that you think about the salt as an actual object, as an actual thing that has a shape and size and character to it. And to try to divorce the salt from that and dissolve it into solution to talk about its chemical components, to me, is doesn't make any sense at all, because that's not how we eat salt.
Right.
We eat salt as a thing. So it's sort of like if you're going to talk about, say, I don't know, really good pizza, and then to taste it, you put it in a blender and add it into a bunch of water and then tasted it, and you compared people's pizzas. To me, that makes no sense at all. So,
yeah, crunch is
huge.
Very important to me. Yeah.
And so, and that itself is also very beautiful and complex. To give you an example, crunch can be for a flake salt can be this bright, quick kind of snap, or in a coarse, moist sel gris, you'll have these clumps and agglomerations of different crystals stacked up on top of each other with a lot of moisture locked up inside. And you get this beautiful, yielding, more kind of supple crunch. And that can be, and it'll be very differently. It'll communicate its saltiness and its flavor, and it will interact with the food much differently depending on how that crunch hits you.
Well, and even a fleur de sel from the Garand versus one from the Camargue, from the Garand, I find the crystals are much more desirable to me. That they're a little slower to dissolve. They're you know, the crunch is better. My husband will be the first. He won't accept anything else. He goes, "This isn't the regular salt that we usually have." You know,
that's a really good point, and that's funny because you know in France you could go to war over that. The South produces on the Mediterranean, they produce some fleur de sel. And on the Atlantic coast, they produce fleur de sel in these very ancient Celtic salt-making settlements. And the two salts are actually made using very similar techniques that are adapted to reflect the climate. But the salts are entirely different. And you're right, the crystal, the crunch, as you put it, is very, very different. If you look at a fleur de sel de Camargue, it's quite translucent.
Mm-hmm.
It's sheeny and bright and quite translucent. And if you look at a fleur de sel from Garand, you see it's clouded by a ton of little imperfections and inclusions in the crystal.
And a lot more moisture.
A lot more moisture.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, there are people who, you know, super tasters who are very sensitive. Interesting, super tasters, however, are not those who will taste the food and say it's too salty. They're sensitive to bitter flavors, but not saltiness. And some people are very, very sensitive to saltiness. And for others, there's never enough.
Yeah, I'm actually more the former. People think I'm just trying to be cute, but I don't actually like salty food. I love salt, but I love salt to do its job, which is to bring flavor.
Enhance the flavor of the other foods.
It's there to celebrate and make everything shine.
Look at today. We have the salted caramels, the salted chocolates. You talk a lot about that in your book too. And that salt does have a job to transport those flavors and really enhance them. And
that's a huge part about tasting salt as well, is you don't eat salt by itself. It's designed, its whole purpose is to accentuate the flavor of food. So when you talk about the tasting of a salt, you really need to look at how that particular salt is going to do its job with a given food.
Well, and we now include umami as one of our flavors, and salt does have that ability to enhance that umami.
Oh, yeah.
Richness, flavor, that earthy, round flavor that we get.
Some salts even have a little umami of their own.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, like a Japanese sea salt I can think of called Moshio. It's this gorgeous kind of beige cafe au lait color. And it has this beautiful umami flavor. You put that on something like on rice or on a lighter color fish, and you get this, or a cucumber sandwich, and you get this amazing rich umami quality to your food.
Oh, in tasting salts, I liked how you said cucumber was the perfect vehicle for tasting salts. And yeah.
Not everybody's most exciting food, but
well, and it shouldn't be. Right. I mean, we're tasting salt after all, you know. So
when we do a class on salt, which we do about every month, both in Portland and in New York, as well as elsewhere, like cooking schools, what we usually present is a slice of cucumber, or say 6 slices of cucumber and 6 pieces of bread and butter. And we taste 6 salts.
Blind tasting, right?
Sometimes not, because I don't eat blindfolded, so I like to eat with my eyes too. And I think that you put a little bit of salt on the bread and butter and a little bit of the salt on the cucumber. And so now you have the play of the salt on two very different kinds of foods.
Texture, yeah, and the texture and then the moisture, viscosity.
Moist vegetal, fatty, but bready, buttery.
Tell me a little bit about your opinions on flavored salts.
I like them. I think that they're cool. For us, we...
And I'm talking about things like truffled salt.
Yeah,
and,
exactly. And we sell a variety. We probably have, out of our 120-ish salts, we have maybe 10 or 12 flavored salts. For me... The flavored salt needs to accomplish something that's a little bit greater than the sum of its parts, meaning you can take anything and put it in salt and it's going to taste good. However, not everybody can afford a beautiful black Italian truffle, you know, that's whatever those things cost now, $1,000.
Quite a bit, right.
So, but a truffle salt does a much, much better job of capturing and honestly portraying all the beautiful aromatic flavors of a truffle. So for a pinch, which is about a penny or two of truffle salt, you get a beautiful Italian black truffle on your food, or your French fries, or your baked potato, or your risotto. And it's just kind of black truffle on tap. So for us, it's always got to have a sort of a strategic dimension to it.
Yeah. Well, we are just about out of time, and I'm sorry, because I really wanted to talk about some recipes. You don't have anything out, you know, that terribly out of the ordinary.
No.
Maybe some of the flavored salts around the rim of a glass for drinks, you know, which are quite nice. But one thing that did catch my attention that I thought was most people would not be familiar with or and was very interesting to me was cooking with salt bricks. Now that was that I thought was quite unique and quite interesting to include.
Yeah, that's a ball. I mean, the enormous. I've
had it certainly like sushi served on a brick plate, but we're talking about cooking with it, right?
Yep.
Or on it.
Almost all the recipes in the book are intended to just help people to cook and eat better. So it's not intended to dazzle. It's how to do a steak or how to do make a green salad, anything that we eat in our daily lives.
I didn't mean to demean the recipes. Yeah. I'm just saying, but they're not, don't buy the book just for the recipe, but buy it for the knowledge.
Unless you don't know how to salt a salad.
Right.
And that's the idea, is to get people to salt things in their daily lives more effectively. But yes, there are also there are lots of really wonderful novel things you can do with salt. And taking a block of this huge luminescent pink Himalayan salt from Pakistan, heating it up on the stovetop to 500 degrees.
Right on top of a gas flame.
Right on your gas burner. Put it on there like a big skillet. And it has this incredible thermal stability. It makes cast iron feel like tinfoil. And then you throw flank steak on there, or scallops, or shrimp.
But you have to heat it for about a half an hour first.
Takes about half an hour, 45 minutes to heat it.
So it's like lighting a charcoal fire.
But it sears your food and salts it, and it gets a salty glaze. It's the most delicious thing you could ever taste.
And it doesn't dissolve with the fats, right?
No, because salt isn't fat soluble. So when you're doing it hot enough to actually sear, the moisture in the food doesn't come out fast enough to really over-season your food. So when you do it perfectly with a really hot salt block, your food is actually seasoned to perfection.
And about how hot does this block get, can get?
I've had them up 800, 900 degrees.
Wow.
You can't
get
it hot enough.
It's like the floor of a pizza oven. I mean,
that's exactly right.
Wow. That's amazing. And you even included a picture of a salt bowl.
A nice big bowl, and then you make a chocolate fondue in there. You get a lightly salted chocolate fondue.
Okay, it's time to eat. Mm-hmm. It's time for lunch. Mark Bitterman, it has been a pleasure. And Mark Bitterman is the author of Salted, a book all about salt, and the owner of The Meadow in Portland, Oregon, and New York City, and a sommelier. Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank our executive producer, Jack Inslee. This has been Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. And now here's some behind-the-scenes food news with Katie Kiefer.
I notice that the beef industry is doing its very best to counteract the negative press that they have gotten for years about commodity beef production methods or commodity livestock production. They've just started a Feed Yard Foodie blog, which is written by a woman who does run a feed yard operation out in Nebraska. I'm not going to endorse or condemn what she writes, but I think it does present an opportunity for consumers to learn more about the commodity livestock industry. You can take from it what you will, but I definitely urge you to check it out. It's always good to see what the other side says. You can find this at feedyardfoodie.wordpress.com. Check it out. This is Katie Kiefer for Behind the Scenes Food News.
Did you know we have a beer show? Check out a small clip from Beer Sessions Radio.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, and I'm here with Ray Dieter from the DBA Boys.
Hey, Jim.
Ray, this is a fun show. We're drinking Belgian beer. We're drinking Ichtigum, hanging out with the guys from 124 Rabbit Club. We got Don and Wendy from Van Berg and the Wolf. Well, let's go back a little bit to kind of build your pedigree. So the two of your top brands that we love and that you have now, Scaldis and Saison DuPont.
Yeah,
tell us how you met those guys, how you started working with them.
Well, Saison DuPont was really... that was.
If you want to hear more, head over to heritageradionetwork.com where new episodes of Beer Sessions are posted every week in our archive. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. In the next few weeks, Heritage Foods USA will be offering an interesting variety of amazing products, ranging from top-quality seafood to their famous pork cuts. At the end of May, the Heritage team will go up to Maine to harvest fresh lobster with sustainable lobstermen. These delicious lobster are a perfect way to kick off the summer season. In the pork department, Heritage Foods USA will offer the maple-cured smoked boneless Heritage ham at an unbeatable price. This offer won't last long, so get them while you can. Place your order today at heritagefoodsusa.com or call 718-389-0985. That's 718-389-0985 to place your order with Andrea or Ashley. And don't forget to sign up for the email list and to check them on Facebook and Twitter to get in on their new products, deals, and offers from Heritage Foods USA.